So you don't usually hear the word Albany and the phrase never a dull moment in the same sentence, but you could almost write such a sentence these days. What with the election last week that brings the state one Senate seat from full Democratic Party control, Mayor Bloomberg then trying to prevent that by writing a big check to the state Republicans, the New York Times reporting that Governor Spitzer is skirting the very campaign finance limit he brought into being, and New York Magazine reporting that Joe Bruno basically admitted a conflict of interest to them, and Bruno's big defense being that he did it off the record. Not to mention that by the end of this month, the state legislature must either give birth to or block congestion pricing for New York City, and today's story about an assembly proposal for a new tax on millionaires. Maybe never a dull moment is still too strong for Albany, but not a dull moment right now certainly applies. And with me, no dull journalists, Daily News political columnist and former Albany reporter Liz Benjamin and New York One Albany bureau chief Josh Robin. We'll hear later from the New York Magazine reporter who broke the Bruno story. But Liz and Josh, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
I want to talk a lot about the implications of this special election, but I want to begin with Governor Spitzer and the campaign finance limits. Josh, what's this about?
Well, this is about a governor who came into office really stressing reform, and he unilaterally imposed limits upon himself of $10,000 donations, which is significantly less than what he could receive under current law. The problem now, which emerged in the Times story, is that donors have been subtly or perhaps overtly directed, we probably will never know, to not give money to not give more than $10,000 to the governor, but give it instead to the Senate Democrat Campaign Committee, which is essentially the governor's pocketbook to take back the one house of the legislature, which is still in Republican hands. And they've been given far more than $10,000 there. So it's kind of raised some eyebrows that this reformer of a governor is actually not so much when it comes really to push, when the push comes to shove.
And Liz, what are the implications of this?
Well, it's actually not just the Senate Dems, but also the Democratic Party, which in fact bankrolled that special election that you were talking about in the North Country to the tune of about $1.6 million. So we're not talking about chump change. It's actually quite a lot of money. And the governor, you know, would like to have it both ways. He'd like to be seen as a reformer, certainly. And this is a criticism that the Senate Republicans and Joe Bruno have levied on him. He'd like to say, you know, I am going to be a reformer, but at the same time, you know, I can't unilaterally disarm for myself. Okay, fine. But I want to take over the Senate. And so I'm going to declare war on you. And while I do that, could you send some money to this account over here?
Yeah. And not just a reformer, really the ethics police. I mean, the sheriff of Albany as governor after he was the sheriff of Wall Street as attorney general. I think it was the heart of his campaign, Josh.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, changing business as usual there. And it's not just campaign finance that people have been, you know, concerned about. Also, the budget process last year was done basically when it really counted in secret. It was done behind closed doors, and this from a governor who I think would have preferred, or at least he says he would have, to have done it in the open, but wasn't able to. And then all of these additional deals that have been going on, whether it's congestion pricing or other things that are going on in Albany right now, are also done really behind closed doors. So it's a question of, have things really changed that much since the governor took over in January of 2007?
Behind closed doors.
Yeah, why?
Well, because it used to be, and Josh will recall, that they would say, hey, there's a leaders meeting, journalists. You have to come down and stand outside the door and wait while Bruno and Shelley and the governor at the time, Governor Pataki, you know, wrangle out. And then they would come out and make statements one at a time. Now we don't even get a heads up. Nobody says, hey, by the way, there's a leaders meeting. If you happen to catch them walking downstairs and walking to the governor's office, I mean, do you get a heads up, Josh? Because I certainly don't.
You have to really, like, hustle and try to work it. And a lot of it is done, yeah, definitely behind closed doors in complete secret. I think this is a governor who's really interested, with his poll numbers, you know, in the toilet. He's interested in results at this point. But it's come at a process that is also bringing down his poll numbers. So he can't really win in this situation, I guess.
So his defense, Liz, on the campaign finance loophole around his own campaign finance regulation is that he doesn't want just his party to unilaterally disarm?
Well, he hasn't really necessarily made that defense. It's more his people have made that defense, which is essentially the same thing. And then words aren't coming out of the governor's mouth per se, right. But he has said, I am holding myself to this incredibly high standard. And, of course, David Patterson, the lieutenant governor, is doing the same because the governor wants him to. But at the same time, you know, I didn't impose these on the Democratic Party, nor did I impose these on the Senate, which is poised, Democrats, which are poised to take over, because, you know, if he did that, they would lose, right? So it's sort of a catch-22. He'd like to be seen in one light, but the reality is that he's dying to take over the Senate, and you can only do that if you got bucks.
Is there blame to go around? Because when the whole Troopergate thing broke last summer, and Joe Bruno and the state Senate stopped cooperating on things they had been cooperating on, one of the first victims was a campaign finance law that would have strengthened things even more.
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, if people really expected, at the outset, I think that there were some, and we're talking right when the governor came in January of last year, there were some intractable issues that there were deals on. For example, you know, sex offender, civil confinement, and workers' comp reform. And then subsequently, if anyone expected there was going to be love and marriage between Joe Bruno, who used to be an ally with the Republican governor and now is the odd man out, they were just wrong. It was wrong to expect that, and it was just not going to happen. And the governor actually started this war against Bruno prior to even getting in. He was running candidates and making ads and helping flip seats. You know, we knew what it was. It was the non-aggression pact broken in, you know, 2006.
Meanwhile, it seems to be happening anyway at the ballot box, as my guests are Liz Benjamin from the Daily News and Josh Robin from New York One here on WNYC. Last week, there was a special election for a state Senate seat in the Adirondacks. Now, for most of our listeners, it probably couldn't compete for attention downstate against things like that other little election campaign in Texas and Ohio and the start of the Sean Bell trial and a baby delivered to a firehouse. But if a politician falls in the forest and nobody hears it, there still can be noise, and in this case, probably big noise. So, Josh, what happened in the Adirondacks last week, and how close does it bring New York State to a historic shift of power?
It brings it very close. What happened was there was the retirement of a Republican state senator whose name was Jim Wright, and the governor announced a special election. And the Democrats put up a pro-life Democrat who's an assemblyman obviously from the district. The Republicans put up a pro-choice assemblyman, so they were members of the assembly. They run against each other. The governor raises a ton of money. The Senate Majority Leader raises a lot of money. Neither of them actually, Bruno and Spitzer, actually never make any appearances in the district because their poll numbers are so low. Big battle back and forth, a lot of attention, a campaign issue about fishing in a river up there emerges. That's a pretty parochial issue. And what happens is Daryl Albertine, who is the Democrat, takes over in a seat that has not been Democratic since the 1880s.
Yeah.
So the upshot, what really matters for New York City residents and for everyone in the state, is that the Senate is now a single member away from becoming Democratic for the first time. And for the first time since the Great Depression, all of the branches of government, the executive and the two houses of the legislature would be Democratic. So it's a tremendous amount of energy and concern, energy on the Democratic side, a tremendous amount of concern on the Republican side, because even with that, without the Albertine win, the Republicans are kind of on the defensive when it comes to the election in November. There's a bunch of members who are seen as vulnerable. One of them in New York City, out in Queens, Surf Maltese, and other ones. And also, the governor has made no secret, although he doesn't say it, he makes no secret of the fact that he wants to take over the state Senate, and he has a tremendous amount of problems with their leader.
And now they're one seat away. And this would be historic. Certainly, in my memory, I can't remember covering Albany politics at any time when there wasn't gridlock, right? Because the state Senate has been in Republican hands for so long, the Assembly has been in Democratic hands for so long, and whether we had a Democratic governor like Cuomo or a Republican governor like Pataki, there was always one house that could block the dominant party's initiatives. So what would it mean, Liz Benjamin, if this actually changed and all three men in the room are Democrats?
Not much. I mean, and I'm historically, yes, of course, there would be, it would be all Democratic, et cetera. But, you know, the joke about Democrats is about the circular firing squad. So the reality about having full Democratic control is that you still have personalities. You still have a situation where there are houses with disparate desires and needs and conferences. For example, the Assembly Democratic Conference is going to be predominantly downstate. There is going to be, if the Democrats flip the Senate, still a need to pay attention to upstate, or they'll never hold the Senate. I mean, that's going to be problematic. So the idea that there's going to be peace, love, and happiness, and Eliot Spitzer's going to get everything that he wants just because he flips the Senate and Malcolm's the leader, or not, as the case may be, I mean, if that holds.
That's Malcolm Smith, state senator from Harlem,
right,
who's now the—
Queens.
Who's now the minority leader. He would become the majority leader, what Joe Bruno is now, and the third of the three men in a room.
Right. But they'd fight. I mean, they'd fight. It's just there would be fights still. There would be gridlock
because
to a certain degree.
So, you know, I'm thinking of long-blocked Democratic policies— Rockefeller drug law reform, campaign finance reform, hate crimes laws, gay marriage, whatever else is on the Democratic agenda.
It depends to a certain degree how many seats they control. If say that the Senate flips and it's a one-seat margin, you're not going to be able to do a lot of really sort of, I don't want to say progressive because that word is a little bit loaded, but the kind of stuff that you're talking about, gay marriage, for example, when you look at the polls, people are largely split. It's about, you know, a 50-some-odd, and I know the Empire State Pride agenda will be calling me to correct me on this, but it's kind of, you don't see 70 or 80% of people in New York saying, yes, same-sex marriage is something that we'd like to see. So it would still be the same game of looking at marginal seats, of seats where districts might be difficult to hold, and vote a voting game. Plus, remember, there are some Democrats who are pretty conservative, like, for example, Ruben Diaz comes to mind. And, you know, there and perhaps Carl Kruger, who has also been close to Joe Bruno, he's a Democrat, you know. There are issues regarding the current Democratic conference that I think some people are starting to look at and say, hey, so you're seeing some primaries coming up to change the face of the Democratic Minority Conference because they say, whoa, do we really want these guys in the majority?
You agree with that, Josh? One-party rule wouldn't mean all these stalled Democratic initiatives would start flying through?
Well, when you're talking about gridlock, I was thinking it's going to be a different kind of gridlock. But I do think that there's going to be a certain amount of change. So I disagree a little bit with Liz on the sense that issues like the death penalty, I realize that it's dead in New York, but I think that it's going to be completely dead. And the Republicans are not even going to bring it up and be able to really use it as some sort of issue. I think that New York City is going to see a lot more power now, because if Malcolm stays as the leader, then all three leaders, the three men in the room, are going to be from the five boroughs. There are other issues as well. The gay marriage is one of them. I wonder, when it comes down to the actual, you know, from January, when if it becomes Democratic, I wonder what the governor and what Malcolm Smith are going to put first ahead on the agenda. And I know that the governor is interested in gay marriage, certainly, but I don't think that he's going to press it because it's, like Liz says, such a divisive issue, and the support is just not there. I think if it becomes naturally at the forefront of the agenda, then you know, he certainly would support it.
The governor's interested in gay marriage. Don't tell Silda.
Well, it was a campaign promise. I mean, it was campaign promise that he made. Then subsequently, as soon as he got elected, we all started asking about it. Where's your program bill?
But maybe we see an example of how Democratic one-party rule will not mean that Democratic initiatives fly through in the news today, because you have some Assembly leaders proposing this new income tax on millionaires. And Governor Spitzer, from what I've read, is immediately saying no. Liz, is that the case?
Yes, correct. Governor Spitzer, who is a millionaire, but I don't think that's what the issue is. I mean, I don't think the issue is he doesn't want taxes raised on himself. I think the issue is that he pledged that there would be no new taxes, which is a point that, of course, we could bicker about, because there are many new fees in his budget, and subsequently those are, in some people's eyes, taxes. But taxes, straight taxes, like the kind you pay to the government, he said that he is not going to increase. And so the Assembly Democrats passed this yesterday. It is half of an agenda item that the Working Families Party, which of course is seeing its clout rise because of its assistance to the Senate Democrats in winning these seats, wants it, but it wants that in conjunction with some property tax breaks for the middle class, so they don't look too much like, you know, they're trying to attack the rich, who, of course, ironically, are the people who are sending these checks to the Democratic Party or to the Republican Party or whomever. These are donors. You need these people. You can't really make them angry.
When we continue in a minute, we're also going to bring in Jeff Gray, New York Magazine reporter, who wrote a very tough article on Joe Bruno. In fact, Bruno and his people are firing back, but supposedly he admitted some kind of conflict of interest that he's under investigation for. Anyway, is this going to be the thing that brings down the longtime Senate Majority Leader? We'll bring Jeff Gray into the discussion and take your calls on any of these things going on in Albany, 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692, and we haven't even gotten to congestion pricing. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk about wild times in the New York State Capitol. With Josh Robin, New York One, Albany Bureau Chief Liz Benjamin, who writes the Daily Politics column for the Daily News, and also joining us now, New York Magazine reporter Jeff Gray, who has some bad news about Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, though Bruno is fighting back. The bad news is in an article in New York called The Unreformed. For 12 years, nobody could threaten Joe Bruno's pugnacious hold on power, but now Elliot Spitzer finally has him on the ropes. But this is somewhat about what Bruno, at least reportedly, told Gray. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, everybody.
So you did an interview with Bruno, and tell me what came out.
I did many interviews with Bruno, actually, for this story. I mean, it was a feature piece. And we spent a lot of time together, maybe 5 days, around the farm. We split wood. We took a drive on his Kubota. We hung out in the state Senate and just kind of palled around. And, a lot of things came out in those interviews, I think, a lot about where he was from and what formed his thinking and ultimately what he did at Wright Investor Services. And that was one part of it. His thoughts about his wife, who was very sick, and his ultimate battle plan to hold on to the state Senate, and we talked also a lot about his legacy. What was he going to be, the guy who would hold on to the last Republican institution in New York, or was he the guy who was going to lose it? And I don't know. I mean, we had the conversations just really kind of ran the gamut.
Right. But for all that palling around and all the hunting and fishing and talking about his family and his legacy, there's one quote that seems to be sticking. You want to talk about it?
Sure. I mean, the quote that got attention in the Times is about what he did for Wright Investor Services. And, at the time, during the interview, to me, this was not, explosive material. I just asked him, in trying to understand what he actually did for this company, because a lot of people find it hard to believe that you can be the state's most powerful Republican and also have time for extra work. And, part-time legislation, as he explained, has a long history in the state. But, so basically I asked him what he did for the company, and he told me that he, provided marketing advice, sales advice, and he helped pension trustees and, I believe, college trustees. And he arranged meetings to have them speak with investors or the executives from Wright about possibly investing money in them. And under no commitments, no strings attached, he said. He just basically set up the meetings, and if you liked each other, I can't remember the exact language, but if you liked each other, continue mm-hmm. the relationship. If you don't, say goodbye.
So, Liz Benjamin from the Daily News, why is this an issue?
Well, I think the issue is twofold. And the explosive quote is something like to the effect of, I'm worried that the FBI, that there might be something out there that they have heard from somebody. I mean, that, it was more forthcoming than he has ever been about that he's actually concerned about this. Not necessarily that he thinks he did something, but he thinks that the FBI has the ability to dig something up, okay? But the other issue is why this is so explosive is because the people that he was setting up these sort of allegedly harmless meetings have interests before the Senate. And some of these people are donors. You're talking about unions that, that made pension investments with Wright. They're local unions, largely, although not entirely. There's some in New York City as well. But Joe Bruno has incredible power, particularly locally. He gives out a lot of money in member items. He is like a god. The man has about four things named after him, okay, including the parts of the airport and the Joe, which is a stadium upstate that's named for him. So he's a very prominent figure. He's very powerful. And if some powerful guy says to you, hey, you should meet with this guy and you should, you know, you want to invest, you don't want to invest, it's up to you. Okay. I mean, there's a little bit of an inference there that a powerful guy says you should do something, you're probably going to do it.
Josh, want to get in on this?
Well, as Jeff was saying earlier, this is a part-time legislature and there's no laws that I know of within the state that says that he cannot do this, but it does certainly give the appearance of impropriety. And
if he used his position to set up situations from which he then personally benefited without disclosing that he was going to personally benefit, that's problematic, I believe illegal. Not
that
illegal for
look,
you to have moonlight. Not
that's
illegal
something,
to
that's
moonlight.
That's something that the FBI is looking
right,
at. But we should also bring in the fact that Shelley Silver is also an incredibly powerful person within the legislature and also has a job that he has not given really any information about, and that's with a very prominent personal injury firm here in New York City. And he also has a lot of the power to write the laws within the state that are benefiting the very people who employ him in a salary and give him a salary that we don't know.
And he just appointed a guy who's
the
a
head
partner
of the firm.
At the firm to a judicial screening committee for which he makes no money, but it's a prominent position, and the guy's going to pick judges. He's going to recommend
the
judges.
The problem is that I think we're at a cusp right now where the legislature might not become part-time anymore, because in the past it used to be, you know, farmers and, you know, people here in the city coming up and spending a couple of months in the legislature and then coming back. And now people see it as a full-time job.
It used to be basically like January to March, right?
Right.
And now it's a lot more than that, partly because they can't get the budget passed by April 1st for 20 years in a row, but that's another story. But so Jeff Gray from New York Magazine, apparently Bruno and his people are so upset that you published this quote that was more forthcoming than he's ever been about his concern about the investigation, that they're kind of bashing back. And one of the things that I read is they're saying, hey, that was off the record. You weren't supposed to publish that. So they kind of acknowledge that they say it, but just that it was off the record. Is that what you're hearing?
I mean, that's what they said. I don't know if they said it's off the record or out of context. It was an on-the-record interview. You know, I specifically remember when that happened. We checked all this stuff during our fact-checking process with their people. I don't know. I mean, I think that it's, you know, when someone, like when the Times story came out, I think that this was just a way for them to distance themselves from the piece. I think that Joe Bruno was known to be a very candid and straight-shooting guy, as he was with me. And this is one of the areas that he was talking about. And his position is always like he's never done anything wrong and he doesn't have anything to hide. And that was the tone and tenor of a lot of our conversations about Wright investors and other areas.
All right. Jeff Gray, his piece in March 1st, New York Magazine, about Joe Bruno called The Unreformed. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
And we continue on WNYC with Liz Benjamin from The Daily News and Josh Robin from New York One. And Mayor Bloomberg is apparently trying to save the bacon of the New York Republican Party. How big a check is he writing?
$500,000.
And that's just one of many checks that he's given to them.
Well, right. He had actually given over the years back when he used to be a Republican. Of course, he is no longer a Republican. And when
or a Democrat.
Time, was a Democrat, right. He was a very large benefactor of the Republican Party, of the Assembly Republicans to a smaller degree, and also to the Senate, giving them in excess of $600,000, the largest benefactor that they have. And that's even including unions and whatnot. So that's pretty significant. So his people are spinning it that this is nothing new. The mayor considers Joe Bruno a friend. In fact, in Gray's story that we were discussing, he actually says some things like, you know, I go up and hang out with Bruno and he makes me popcorn, which is kind of funny. But just to see that mental image.
It's kind of sweet. They could order it in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, in Albany, you know, it's hard to get popcorn ordered.
Yeah, I guess so.
They, you know, the mayor's people are like, look, he's been good to the city. There were times when Shelley Silver, and of course, there's no secret that the assembly speaker and the mayor are not exactly seeing eye to eye, but, you know, on things like, say, the stadium or even congestion pricing for that matter. And we just want to continue supporting him. Except the thing is, now it's no longer like you're funding the guerrillas at the border. Now you're sending plutonium to the Russians. You know, it's a different story. It's a nuclear war.
Right. So what are there issues that his independence, the mayor, wants to see the Republicans prevail on by preventing one party rule? Or is this just about personalities? Or is this just about the abstraction of maintaining checks and balances?
It's probably a little bit of all three. But I'd say that there is a bunch of issues that Senator Bruno is very receptive to the mayor on, including congestion pricing, which is probably forefront of the mayor's agenda right now when it comes to Albany. And even though the Republicans are supposed to be about less government and less money, Joe Bruno has signaled his support for this congestion pricing plan, and it needs to go through Albany. I just think that
needs to go through the city council first.
City council first and then Albany. But I just think that from a political standpoint, it wasn't a very good move for him to give this money to Bruno, because it's, if anything, it's just alienated all of these Democrats who were on the fence, if not opposed to congestion pricing. So now they're saying, you know, why should we even do this for the mayor? It's a mayor's project when he's giving money to the Republicans.
And we've also seen subsequently that it didn't really help his relationship with Eliot Spitzer, who, of course, like we said earlier, wants to help the Senate Democrats and oust Joe Bruno. And now you see that the governor and the mayor are in somewhat of a tussle. And it also, the sort of subtext of this is, will Mayor Bloomberg or won't he, when he gets out, you know, and when he's term limited out of office, decide, no, actually, I would really like this whole elected official thing. And even though he says he doesn't want to go to Albany, just like he said he didn't want to go to Washington, perhaps in 2010 he would like to go. And polls show that if the race was taken, was held today.
Let's go to Albany as governor.
Yeah, the mayor would defeat Eliot Spitzer. So I think that, and plus he has all this money that he could just spend.
Now, this is the month by which the legislature has to approve congestion pricing in order to get those truckloads of federal dollars, which I guess would park at 86th Street, and then they would carry them by hand south of there. But let's take a congestion pricing call from George on Staten Island. George, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. One of the problems that we have is I drive into the city often, but I normally park at the Queens Plaza parking garage, and because it sits right on top of the three subway lines.
Uh-huh.
And now they've just closed that parking garage in advance of congestion pricing. It doesn't make any sense.
They closed the Queens Plaza parking garage. I didn't know that.
It takes about
permanently. Permanently? Are they doing some kind of construction there, or what's the reason?
Supposedly going to replace it with a traffic department office building.
Huh, interesting. Mm. Now, of course, there are neighborhoods like Long Island City, where that parking lot is, that aren't thrilled about congestion pricing because they say that's exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. Everybody's going to come from all over, park right here, and then take, you know, a little skippy-hoppy ride on the subway across the river, and then there's going to be all this new pollution there.
Right. One of the things that the Department of Transportation is looking into, if congestion pricing gets passed, is a residential parking permit program. I don't know how it would work. I'm not sure they know exactly how it would work, but you would apply for a parking permit and only a certain amount of parking spaces would be given for those who are just commuting into the neighborhood. And people north of 60th Street and in the areas in the outer borough, so to speak, are very concerned about the program. And so are their lawmakers.
Guess what? Tom in Brooklyn remembers the last time that the Democrats had control of all three houses. Tom, you're on WNYC.
Well, they didn't have all three houses.
Oh.
Only two houses.
Two houses and the governorship is what I meant. But is that true? No, 65 was Rockefeller, right?
Rockefeller. But what happened was LBJ came in with such a landslide that the Republicans lost across the state. And the first order, when they got the two houses in order, the first order of business, as is always true, is reelection. So they remapped the districts of the state of New York in 1965 to ensure the Democrats would win and be perpetuated. But it didn't work. In 1966, the Republicans grabbed control again. But if you want to really get scared about things, think of a Tom DeLay in charge of any part of the state of government. And what would happen? You're talking about Mr. Bruno having all these goodies. Well, that's the way Tom DeLay worked, except Tom DeLay then turned around and says, we're going to eliminate the Democrats make it perpetual.
Yep.
And they will not be running on, those people who get elected will want to run on the issues that will get them reelected. That's not gay rights. That's not the death penalty. That's dollars and cents.
Yeah, you make a really good point, and the point is that if and when the Democrats take control, the most important thing that they will control is redistricting. Mm-hmm. And the governor has said he wants nonpartisan redistricting. There's actually a bill out that Mike Gianaris from Queens, the assemblyman from Queens, took a lot of flack from his colleagues because he wants to create an independent redistricting commission. And there's sort of lukewarm support for this, but the interesting part is, so if the Democrats control the drawing of the lines, they will draw lines that essentially will keep them for a generation, if not more, in power, because the way things are gerrymandered right now, it's like these insane, you know, ways where you go all the way out of your way to catch this Republican over here or whatever. But the other problem is, and of course the state is becoming more and more Democratic, but enrollment-wise, the other problem is that the legislature controls the drawing of the congressional lines. And so it's possible the state is poised to lose two seats in the congressional delegation because we don't grow as fast population-wise as compared to other states. Democrats could redistrict. Traditionally, it's one Democrat and one Republican if two seats need to go. But if the Democrats control it, they could just get rid of two Republicans. There's only, I believe, six in the delegation.
This brings us back full circle to what we started with at the beginning of the hour. Spitzer ran on the idea of ethical reform in Albany, instituted this $10,000 limit, which is a pretty high limit to begin with, but that's another story, on campaign donations, and then has been finding ways to circumvent it. It would be a challenge for him, if the Democrats do take control of the entire legislature, to stick to his promise to do nonpartisan redistricting rather than partisan grab redistricting.
Yeah, it's already, there's lukewarm support for it. When Malcolm Smith went down to Washington and in the last, I'd say, 6 months and had a conversation with the congressional delegation, there was not a lot of enthusiasm for this idea that it would be completely nonpartisan, because you see every 10 years after the census is taken, congressmen and women either hiring lobbyists or coming up themselves and lobbying the state legislature because they don't want to have their lines changed and have to run against each other or learn new constituents or anything like
we're
that.
We're just about out of time, but I want to take 1 minute here for you two to give everybody a Troopergate update, because just when everybody thinks this is fading to nothingness, then up pop these stories like David Soares, the Albany DA, is now conducting three different investigations or whatever it is. So give me your best minute on Troopergate, Josh.
All right. The best minute on Troopergate is that three different entities right now are investigating the governor. And just a 10-second recap, this is whether the governor and his aides planted negative information about Joe Bruno, leaked it, and used the state police to get the information. So David Soares, the Albany DA, is looking into it. The Commission on Public Integrity, which is this state agency, is looking into it. And also Joe Bruno's Republican-controlled state Senate is looking into
it. But is there something new? Is there some new suspicion?
Well, yeah. I mean, sort of. I mean, the issue is that the DA cleared the governor of any wrongdoing back in October, and then subsequently is looking at it again. It is actually putting people under oath and subpoenaing people to come in, including the governor's office, for reams of emails and phone records, et cetera. The question really is whether some aides to the governor pressured another aide to the governor, or coerced or threatened, who is no longer there and is now working for a lobbying firm as a PR specialist, to sign a statement that was potentially false that went to Andrew Cuomo.
If he's subpoenaing all this stuff, Andrew Cuomo, is he on a fishing expedition or is he onto something specific?
Well, the DA, not
Andrew
Cuomo,
the Albany DA,
right.
I'm sorry.
It's hard to say. I mean, my take on it is, if in fact all of those emails became public, I'm sure there would be embarrassing stuff in there. And the real question is whether or not the governor knew, how much he knew and when he knew it, because he always said that it wasn't him, right? It was his aides. Now, that none of that's illegal. It's just embarrassing. And why would he lie to the public like that?
And it's and he can't do anything about Soares' investigation. He can do something about Joe Bruno's investigation.
Well, they're in court over that. They're in court over the right of the power of a Senate committee, a legislative committee, to subpoena the executive.
Liz Benjamin writes the Daily Politics column in the Daily News. Josh Robin covers Albany for New York One. Thanks a lot, both of you.
Thanks, Brian.
And for those of you politically obsessed, You should know that WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein and I have made a historic decision. We've decided to extend our weekly podcast, Digesting Politics, which was supposed to end on Super Tuesday. We will now continue it until the Democrats have a nominee. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. We'll be recording a new one this afternoon, so sign up for the Digesting Politics podcast for free at WNYC.org. But coming up in a minute, something of great import. A New York City bar bans Danny Boy just in time for St. Patrick's Day. We'll get your reaction.